Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. This week, I'll be talking with John K. Bardis, an assistant professor of history at Louisiana State University. His new book, The Carceral City, Slavery and the Making of Mass Incarceration in New Orleans, 1803 to 1930, was just named Humanities Book of the Year by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. John K. Bardis is an assistant professor of history at Louisiana State University. His new book, The Carceral City, Slavery and the Making of Mass Incarceration in New Orleans, 1803 to 1930, was just named the Humanities Book of the Year by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. John will receive the award at the Bright Lights Dinner April 23rd in Baton Rouge. For ticket info, visit leh.org. Well, John, welcome to The Reading Life and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's a real treat and honor.
Now, this is a fascinating book. It's so rich in detail, and I know it took a long time. But first, what was it that inspired this passion for this subject in you?
I used to be a Louisiana school teacher, and I was teaching in New Orleans, and I became increasingly struck and alarmed at the extent to which my students, and especially my students of color, how their options and life trajectories were really shaped by a pervasive criminalization of them. That people in Louisiana, because as a function of my students being poor and black and urban, perceived them as inherently criminal. So I wanted to understand how these ideas that fabricate this link between race and criminality, I wanted to understand where those ideas came from and how they evolved historically over time.
Well, it is kind of daunting. You know, you point out this is a city that incarcerates people at the highest rate of any American city, within the state that incarcerates people at the highest rate of any American state, within the country that incarcerates more people than any other nation on the globe.
Yes. You know, what I found, what really shocked me is that this relationship that's particular to the United States, but also particular to Louisiana, this dense relationship between race and the prison, is way, way older than I think a lot of people have assumed.
I know. I had never really thought that much about the origin of prisons, which, of course, you write a lot about in this.
Yes, that's right. You know, I think we take for granted the idea that prisons exist because they've existed throughout our lifetimes. But the prison, as we understand it, is only an institution that's really only about 200 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's also an institution that is deeply interwoven in American history. It's one of America's lasting contributions to the world. It's an institution originally developed right here in America after the American Revolution by thinkers who were anxious that a democracy needed a different kind of punishment system than what had previously existed in Europe.
I don't know if this is true, but it's just my feeling that we're in a great time of scholarship about incarceration and about slavery as well, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. I think that, you know, in particular in the last 30 years where incarceration rates in the United States have exploded to a degree unprecedented in world history, more and more scholars and historians are looking at this country's complicated relationship with imprisonment, with race, with slavery, and have begun trying to unpack how these different forms of violence are related.
And you even point out that the word chain gang was first used in New Orleans.
Yes, that's right. The word chain gang and the practice of chaining prisoners together and putting them to work outside as a way of publicly humiliating them, particularly black men and women, that collection of ideas is something that was first introduced to the United States through New Orleans, and it's from New Orleans that penal labor system spread throughout the country.
Now, when you go back, one of the misperceptions that you knocked down right away is the fact that enslaved people could be and were often incarcerated in great numbers and in special slave prisons. So talk about that early relationship between slavery and prisons.
Yeah, well, I think there's this myth out there that says that slave societies fundamentally had no use for prisons because enslaved people were only ever punished by their enslavers. And I think this assumption makes sense intuitively. Like, incarceration resembles slavery in some ways. An enslaved mm-hmm. person already doesn't have any freedom. So what would be the point of incarcerating an enslaved person? But what I found in my research and that really shocked me is that this narrative, this assumption just simply isn't true. That in parts of the South, enslaved people were arrested and incarcerated at truly astronomical rates, and they were jailed and forcibly worked through very advanced networks of government-managed, publicly funded prisons, slave prisons that were built exclusively and that were designed exclusively for the confinement of enslaved people. In particular, in New Orleans, which is the focus of my book, the incarceration rate in these slave prisons was shockingly high. To put things in context, or to put a hard figure on it, enslaved people in New Orleans were incarcerated at higher rates then than Black Louisianians were after the Civil War, or then, in fact, than Black Americans are incarcerated today. The incarceration rate among Black Americans was higher under slavery than it is today.
And there were also complicating factors. There were poor whites who were also rounded up by the state. There were free people of color who were often taken in with slaves as well. New Orleans had some unusual circumstances, I think, that made this more complicated.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. I mean, as you said, poor white people in New Orleans were arrested and jailed at some of the highest rates this country has ever seen. Before the Civil War, during the age of slavery, and free people of color were also arrested and jailed at really shockingly high rates. I mean, again, there's this assumption that a slave society didn't have any use for government-managed coercive systems, that it was all done in the privacy of a plantation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the opposite is true, that slaveholders in New Orleans and pro-slavery lawmakers firmly believed that the government had a very, very important role to play in the management of society and in the protection of slavery. They were completely committed to the idea that the state should deploy public resources to help slaveholders maximize their control and their profit.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with John K. Bardis, an assistant professor of history at LSU. He's the author of a new book, The Carceral City, Slavery and the Making of Mass Incarceration in New Orleans. Well, a lot of this had to do with the problem of labor, like for harvest, for other forms of production and work. They would round up to be sure they had enough work gangs.
Yes, this dynamic was common in New Orleans, in Louisiana, and throughout the American South, really all the way up to the 1970s, where it was understood that right at the start of harvest season, police would go out and round up people, both as a way of creating penal labor crews and as a way of pressuring workers into accepting work harvesting crops at the lowest possible wage. That there was a long-standing tradition that spanning the 19th century and well into the 20th century of using public police power to help secure minimal labor costs for planters and industry.
And one of the things that I found interesting is that you also made sure to capture some of the stories of the women.
Yes. I to be completely frank, in conducting this research, the topic that disturbed me the most, and there's a lot of really disturbing content that I came across in my research, but the topic that disturbed me the most was the way that slaveholders used slave prisons in particular to sexually coerce enslaved women. Incarceration rates among Black women were very, very high in antebellum New Orleans, and many slaveholders did this because they didn't want to directly inflict personal violence on Black women they were attempting to sexually assault, but they saw that by incarcerating a woman or threatening to incarcerate a woman, they could wield incredible coercive power over her. And this, these slave prisons were so deeply embedded in New Orleans society and in the dynamics of slavery in the city that when you look closely, you can see a variety of these dynamics at play, these different ways that slaveholders used and manipulated this prison system.
An example of that is vagrancy laws. You write at great length about vagrancy laws.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, vagrancy laws used to be so, so important in this country, and we have forgotten what a central role they once played not too long ago. I mean, most Americans today, I think, probably aren't even familiar with what a vagrancy law is, but it is a law which criminalizes people who look as though they are underemployed, mm-hmm. people who look like they're not working hard enough, or are shifty, or are itinerant, migratory. It's kind of similar to homelessness, but it's not exactly the same as homelessness. So throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th century, this was the main legal mechanism by which police forces in this country coerced white workers. The idea being that a white worker who took odd jobs or who was underperforming in their labor or who wasn't committed to a single employer, at any moment a police officer could arrest them for vagrancy and work them on a chain gang or as a penal laborer. At the same time that enslaved people were arrested at really high rates in New Orleans, the vagrancy arrest rate in New Orleans was the highest in the country, meaning that police before the Civil War were simultaneously tasked with arresting large numbers of Black people for traveling around the city autonomously, but at the same time they were tasked with arresting white people who were, in their eyes, not working hard enough or who were not committed to a single employer.
Don't you think this is maybe the beginning of profiling?
Very much so. I mean, this is the origin of policing in this country. The first police forces in this country, as we understand a police force, mm-hmm. start to emerge in the early 1800s. And police are a really dynamic institution that perform a huge variety of different societal roles. I'm not trying to oversimplify them as an institution. But one of their tasks in the early 19th century was to identify working people who seemed underperforming or somehow maladjusted and coercing them into being more productive. And that entailed these really subjective, squirmy interpretations of who looks like a good worker.
The great theme that's underneath all this in the book is the idea of state coercion. It seems to me this is something useful for the moment we're living in now.
I appreciate that. I think this complicated relationship we have in this country between freedom, liberty, autonomy on the one hand as core values, and on the other hand, a deep, long tradition of state coercion, that is a tension that is not going to go away anytime soon. Mm-hmm. That's a tension that's hard to work out. And I think, to a certain degree, maybe that tension is deeply embedded in American democracy, that we are a country forged out of contradictory commitments to slavery on the one hand and to personal autonomy and liberty on the other hand. Mm-hmm. And repeatedly, the state has sought to navigate that tension by coercing peoples who are perceived as being not truly qualified for American freedom.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with John K. Bardis, an assistant professor of history at LSU. He's the author of a new book, The Carceral City, Slavery and the Making of Mass Incarceration in New Orleans. One of the things you do that's so interesting is write at great length about the structures, the buildings, and you're writing about the city's new police jail and how they renamed it the House of Detention. Talk a little bit about those kinds of distinctions.
Yeah, so New Orleans built its first slave prison, meaning a prison exclusively designed for the incarceration of enslaved people, all the way back in 1805 after the Louisiana Purchase. And they, you know, this building was rebuilt and expanded and reconfigured at various points throughout the antebellum era. But what really shocked me was that after the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, they didn't close this slave prison, but instead they repurposed and relaunched it as a prison for incarcerating formerly enslaved people. And in many ways, it went on doing as an institution what it had been doing for decades at that point, incarcerating black workers and coercing them through violence. So as I trace this institution through the years and through the years, I was they periodically rebuilt it and tore it down and rebuilt it, but the core institution remained central to the coercion of labor in New Orleans all the way through into the Jim Crow era. So in 1904, for example, they tore down the old slave prison, the last prison that had formed, that had incarcerated enslaved people at one point, and they replaced it with a new jail that was designed to serve the same purpose that they renamed the House of Detention. And that House of Detention, people in New Orleans will know, it was rebuilt. It was torn down and rebuilt a couple times, but the House of Detention as a New Orleans institution endured all the way up until 2013. I mean, you can see it on Broad Avenue now. It is a jail that traces its ancestry all the way back to a slave prison built in 1805.
That's stunning. You go into such detail about what even the showers are like.
As anybody who has been inside the House of Detention can tell you, it is one of the most atrocious, or was one of the most atrocious prisons in the United States. In its history, it was routinely identified by the Bureau of Justice as the single most violent and poorly managed prison in the United States. One of the things that my book explores is this question of how forms of violence change and adapt over time in response to a variety of different societal changes. So to give you an example, this institution that had formerly been a slave prison, when it was a slave prison, there was a whipping rack in the courtyard where enslaved people were strapped down and systematically, almost mechanically whipped. Mm-hmm. And they would whip hundreds of people almost a day. It was like a factory, a conveyor belt for inflicting whippings. With emancipation and the rise of Jim Crow, the whipping rack was removed because that was no longer politically tolerable. But in its place, they built what they called a shower bath box, which was a chair for waterboarding people, for covering their face and pouring water over them. The logic being that waterboarding doesn't leave any physical scars. What I see in that is the adaptability of state violence, that the shower bath box, while a different form of violence, functionally replaced in New Orleans prison system what the whipping rack had previously performed.
Those must have been very hard parts to write.
I hope my next book will be about puppy dogs and rainbows, because this is a very challenging book to write. It is a book about violence. It is a book about racial repression. In writing this book, there were moments where I searched for ways to insert heroic narratives of resistance and redemption. But ultimately, I decided that trying to make this a less depressing book did a disservice to the overwhelming amounts of human suffering that have occurred in New Orleans' jail system, that it was intellectually dishonest and morally reprehensible to try to make it anything less than a profoundly tragic story.
Mm-hmm. And a story that has tendrils that extend to the present day. There's a passage at the beginning of your epilogue that I found so fascinating, and I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that 1967 arrest that you write about.
Yeah, this book covers two centuries of history. And mm-hmm. In the middle of the book, I write about how the policing of emancipation in New Orleans and how formerly enslaved people and free Black activists were targeted by police forces. And then the book ends in the epilogue with the arrest of Mayor Morial on vagrancy charges only a couple of days after he was elected Louisiana's first Black congressman since the end of the Civil War, since the Reconstruction period. That for me, this is just such a eerie case of historical recurrence.
And in front of his own house.
In front of his own house while chatting with his friend and neighbor.
That was the stunning part to me.
And arrested on vagrancy, a law that had been used at that point for 100 years to target Black Americans arbitrarily.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with John K. Bardis, an assistant professor of history at LSU. He's the author of a new book, The Carceral City, Slavery and the Making of Mass Incarceration in New Orleans. So when you were working on this, who's your ideal reader? Who do you really want to take this in and use it?
It is an academic book. It is engaging in discussions with historians who are interested in these questions of slavery and race and violence in the prison. But I also really want to reach out to curious people who aren't historians, who are interested in thinking about those questions and who feel a deep moral commitment to looking with clear eyes at the history of violence in this country. So ideally, I really hope that it can be a book that is useful mm-hmm. and thought-provoking for historians and non-academics alike.
These are things that are done with taxpayer dollars and done in our names.
Right? I mean, we should absolutely need to confront that a tremendous amount of violence has historically been done in the name of taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And exactly to your point, that means that we have, I think, a moral obligation to look it squarely in the eye and to talk about it.
So what are you working on next?
My next book is about a slave insurrection panic that swept the United States in the summer of 1841. And what enslavers thought was happening was that every Black person in the Mississippi River Valley was conspiring to rise up in rebellion simultaneously. But what was actually happening, what they didn't realize was that, but what they were just catching glimmers of, is that Black people working aboard ships on the Mississippi River were moving information and news and secrets and abolitionists and literature up and down the Mississippi River in between enslaved communities. And so it's not exactly a story about rainbows and puppy dog tales, but it is a more uplifting story in that it is the study of this underground communication network that enslaved and free Black people developed in the heart of slave country.
We've been talking with John K. Bardis, whose new book is The Carceral City, Slavery and the Making of Mass Incarceration in New Orleans, 1803 to 1930. John, thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Dave Grant appears in conversation with Gina Swanson of WDSU and signs the corporate playbook, while others play checkers, play three-dimensional chess. That's at brunch Saturday, April 19th at 11 at Baldwin & Company. This is a ticketed event. Journalist and author Robert Mann, professor emeritus of mass communication at LSU, will discuss his new book, You Are My Sunshine, Saturday, April 19th at 2:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Michelle Tracy Berger, author of Doll Seed Stories, and Chin Sun Lee, author of Upcountry, discuss the intersection of speculative fiction and sociopolitical reality, Saturday, April 19th from 4 to 5:30 at Octavia Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.